And yeah, that's it. It's early.
Okay, I'm Gitech. I'm a technology journalist and writer for TorrentFreak.com, and I'm also an occasional contributor to TechDirt over the last 3-4 years. So I've experience of how the suits affected the company somewhat, and what that's meant for the journalist side of things.
All right, yeah, and so I should say that my organization, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, also is very friendly with TechDirt, and in fact, we're giving an award to Mike Masnick in a
couple weeks.
Yeah, the Pioneer Award. So you might imagine this is going to be a relatively sympathetic panel for the TechDirt side of things, but we'll. Try and present it as best as we can.
And so, as litigious free as... steering clear of litigious.
That's right. So you were going to sum up some of the factual history?
Okay, yeah. Okay.
In a
nutshell, yeah. Okay. I got my sum total of notes here, which is the guy's name. The guy's name at the center of this lawsuit is a guy called Shiva... Ayadurai. He's Indian-born, came to the States with his parents aged 4. And essentially his claim is that he invented email at the University College of New Jersey School of Dentistry, where his mother worked, at the age of 14 in 1978. The problem is, he didn't, according to pretty much every objective fact there is, and when TechDirt wrote about this, he got upset and sued, thus the suit. He claims, Ayadurai, or Shiva, we'll call him Shiva for the sake of my tongue and sanity, Shiva claims that he wrote this system, which was the first electronic mail system or email system in the world in 1978 for this school of dentistry, and that it was groundbreaking and unique in that it was the first one to replace or emulate inter-office physical mail with to, from, CC, BCC, subject, etc. The problem is many of these titles and subjects had occurred in a RFC. And don't ask me the name because it's 10 a.m. on a Sunday. But an RFC about 3 years earlier. The other problem with his claim is that in 15, 20 years ago, he claimed he wrote it not in 1978, but in 1980 in some books and things. And his proof is that he got a copyright for the word for a program called Email in 1982. What he calls email is not technically what we'd call email. It's a single system user, and it's a single database system that can be accessed by multiple computers across a local area network. And he has based a lot of his career over the last 20 or 30 years on this claim of him having invented email. And that people are denying him his claim because they're racist against Indians. Despite one of the RFC request for comment authors being Indian himself. So that's the case in a nutshell as far as the facts go. His claim was largely unfollowed. His work was based on nobody else's really, and nobody else built off it or was even aware of it until he started pushing his claims in the late 90s, I think, and so he was an isolated blip that was bypassed and was of limited or no use in the development of email itself, except he would like recognition. And he has been steadfast in his desire for recognition when one of the recognized creators of email, Ray Tomlinson, I think, died a year or two back. He started a smear campaign saying that Tomlinson didn't invent email, he did, and was very nasty to a lot of press who covered Tomlinson's death, kept trying to correct the record. And if you're here for our alternate facts thing, you'd recognize the gist of what he was trying to do there. So that's the facts as they are for how the case came about.
All right. And let me add a few other things about, so on the litigation side of things. Shiva filed a suit against first Gawker, and he was represented by the same attorney who was representing Hulk Hogan in his lawsuit against Gawker. And then it was settled with Gawker as part of that same settlement with the Hulk Hogan suit. So it was sort of a package deal for Gawker, and I was just looking that up, but you got something in the order of...
$750,000.
Yes, okay. A fair amount of money out of that, something that can help sustain perhaps future lawsuits. And then... went after Tech Dirt. So one thing sort of is notable is that Gawker was pretty much crushed by the Hulk Hogan lawsuit and relatively ran out of business. The Tech Dirt was very concerned that this would happen to them as well. And this sort of raises one issue that we can go into some more detail about, but the challenges that are faced by a company that is facing a lawsuit that if it goes badly for them will put them out of business, and the cost of defending it could be a lot. And if the person on the other side has resources, in the case initially of the Hulk Hogan versus Gawker suit, that was Peter Thiel, who had lots and lots of money to bankroll that. Bankroll Hulk Hogan, and then in the case against Textert, we know at least there was like $750,000 to help defray some of those future costs, and there might maybe other resources as well. And so anyway, they filed a suit against Textert. Textert is defending itself. Of course, and they are moved to dismiss the lawsuit, saying that it did not state a claim because what they were doing was in expressing an opinion. And they also said that this lawsuit was a slap suit, a strategic lawsuit against public participation. There are a number of states in which there are anti-slap laws, which means that you can try to address this problem of the expensive and difficult lawsuit by naming it a slap, convincing the judge that it's a slap, and then getting out of the suit much earlier than you ordinarily would. So that is sort of the, at least in many states, the legal response to the problem of people overwhelming you with a defamation lawsuit. And so Tech Dirt has done that as well. I believe that Georgia is a state here that has an anti-slap law. Most states do.
Although most of them are very weak and limited in scope. So.
Yes, this is true. Do you know much about the Georgia one?
I don't know the Georgia one. I'm talking about now. I actually don't.
Well, so I don't know that the Georgia one in particular, but they started out with it about environmental lawsuits. So this was a problem, a couple of decades back. The environmental movement was getting sued every time they complained about a company, and they didn't have the resources to defend themselves. And so a number of the anti-slap laws were about actually restricted to environmental issues. People started to look at it more broadly. Usually they are restricted to some sort of free expression, free speech end of things. and that's the broadest end of it. Sometimes it's when you are doing something which is petitioning the government for redress of your grievances, which covers a fair medium-sized, and sometimes it's very narrow. In any event, Tector was sued in Massachusetts, and they are arguing that under choice of law provisions, California's anti-slap law should apply. Tector is based in California, and they have some decent arguments why the California, which is a really good anti-slap law, should apply.
The real issue, and it really does come down to the resources, is that the challenge of these motions to dismiss or motions to dismiss under the anti-slap laws, which are two separate motions, Tector has filed both, you still have to file the motions. You're still defending yourself. The downside to defending litigation is that it still takes time and expense. There's probably been some significant legal fees already incurred by Tector just in filing the motions that are on record. It's certainly less than if they have to go all the way through to trial, but it's not free, and that is the chilling effect that litigation can have, because people will settle rather than trying to defend themselves. People will not make comments that might get them sued if they see what happened. You know, if you see Gawker gets taken down and then they sue Tector, and well, you know what? I'm going to be a little cautious about what I'm going to say about the inventor of email, who clearly invented email because he invented email, and I'm not going to say he didn't because he might sue me, and I don't want to defend it. So there's a chilling effect to both the public comment and the press coverage. And that is the biggest challenge to litigation, is that even when you're right, it's expensive.
Oh, yeah. And I've done assisted with copyright troll lawsuits, and they can be really expensive to defend, and that's the whole point of copyright troll lawsuits. And indeed, patent troll lawsuits. It costs money, so it's cheaper to settle. So it's easy money.
So this was the impetus behind the slap lawsuit. One other sort of like interesting challenge with defamation. So there's a couple of ways you can defend against a defamation claim. One is that you told the truth. Yeah, it's the truth is a defense. And another would be that the statement you made is a matter of opinion. It can not capable of being proven true or false. Therefore it cannot be defamation. So these seem to be relatively straightforward, but the problem is, you know, that he's not the inventor of email. Is that a statement of fact or truth? Like, he would say, well, I did invent a program called email. We got a copyright registration for it. It sent some messages around. Factually, I invented email. And therefore, if you say something different, that is a false and defamatory lie. And then Tector is saying that, well, no one's disputing that you wrote down some code, called it email, got a copyright registration. We're just disputing that is the email that everybody thinks of as email today. And
that it was first.
And well, that there are other things that came before that that had the characteristics of email, and so it is our opinion that what the thing that we concede as factually you invented is not properly thought of as email, and so this is a constitutionally protected opinion, not a fact that can be proven true or false in the same way. And so that's a big part of the dispute, whether or not it is a fact or an opinion. An important thing to tie that into the cost of lawsuit issue is that you can file a motion to dismiss, have a brief, argue before a judge, and get to the answer about whether it is opinion, and if it is opinion, you're out of the lawsuit. within, you know, months of the lawsuit filing, with notable but not crippling expenses. And that's the stages where they are at now. If you are determining whether a fact is true, this involves a jury and a trial and doing some depositions and discovery, and all of a sudden your costs go up way high. So the difference between getting out early because it is a opinion, or having to prove that something is true, even if it is in fact true, is huge in the cost of things.
And one of the issues that comes up, again, just as part of the realities of litigation, is motions to dismiss are very, very, very hard to be successful on. It is, as long as you can state a claim that on its face makes sense, in many, many states follow the federal rules, and the federal rules say that, you know, as long as I've stated a claim, I might not be able to prove it, but if I've stated a claim, my claim won't be dismissed. You then have to go to another motion stage called summary judgment and prove that I don't have a claim. So a motion to dismiss can be a very high hurdle, and the reality is judges don't like to make decisions that might get overturned. Judges don't like to be the ones who are making that call in many cases. They like to be able to point to a jury and say, well, the jury said it, so, you know, that's what happened.
Are you saying judges are cowards?
No, it's a situation where if I come to a judge with a motion to dismiss, and I say this is not this is factually not true.
Yeah.
Okay, this is a truth is a defense, and this is a true statement. He did not invent email. The judge is then the one who's, if he agrees with me, he's essentially making the determination that this is a true statement.
Yeah, coward was a bad choice of word. Well, sort of afraid to be stuck
but,
on the.
But
yeah.
They're cautious.
I think we should actually
cautious.
Focus on the, yeah, on yeah, the fear.
Yeah,
and the
yeah,
thing.
Yeah.
There are some reasons why we want facts to be determined
right.
by a jury.
Yeah.
Or even if not, I mean, the truth is, the reason a motion to dismiss is much cheaper than litigation is because you get in there before discovery. You get in there before, you know, laying out the facts, taking depositions, getting testimony. So the judge is making his determination based solely on the plaintiff's brief, the defendant's brief, and maybe some lawyer arguments, none of which are actually evidenced of anything. It's just argument. And so judges will often say, let's let this go to litigation. Let's get some discovery. Let's get some facts, and then we can know what the truth is. So it's not to say that in this case, because this is the kind of case that a motion to dismiss might be successful in, but in general, motions to dismiss are a very, very difficult thing to be successful at. And because of that, it's instead of saving you the expense of litigation, it's just another expense on top of the litigation you're already going to end up doing anyway, because you probably won't be successful.
Do anybody have any questions? Do we have the box? All right.
How did they end up going from Thiel and Hulk to this guy against Tector?
I mean, the how, I guess, is, you know, they got to take it up with them. The timing of it was interesting, is that, you know, as has been alleged, Thiel was bankrolling the lawsuit Hulk Hogan versus Gawker, and then the same attorney represented another person who had a claim against Gawker. During that same time period, I don't know if Thiel was also bankrolling that effort or not. It is interesting that the same attorney during the same time frame, and it was settled at the same time.
As a package deal, one case was then associated with the other in basically in the settlements of it. So
I think, as has been suggested, at least that Teal was upset with Gawker with some of the coverage they've had about him. But I didn't either want to sue over that or feel that he had a good suit over that, but in any event, didn't, but instead found this other method and succeeded.
I don't think what he was upset about was... I believe he's upset about the fact that Gawker outed him as gay, and so that he was upset about that because he wasn't public about that, and that's not really something you can really serve about too much.
Just the attorney,
yeah.
The
attorney and the practice of the lawsuit and the timing. So it's kind of like a parallel construction sort of thing. So it's in the thing, and he was looking for... She was been trying to find somebody to sue for these sorts of things, and when Gawker wrote this thing about, no, he's not the email creator, then that, you know, he's... I should also note, by the way, just in the interest of fairness, that Mr. Shiva, or Vash Shiva, as he's sometimes known, is also running for Senate next year in Massachusetts against Elizabeth Warren. And to give you a idea of his position on that, just so you get a better idea of his personality and his thought processes. He's a fervent Trump supporter, calls himself a real American, but also at the same time says that people should vote for him so that it's a real Indian to beat a fake Indian. So that's his sort of tagline.
But I bet he'll have a hell of an email campaign.
Yeah, but only if you're in the one doctor's office.
All right, next question.
So I had a question about the motion to dismiss. If you're not allowed to present factual evidence, then what really is the basis of that? How does that actually come about to be something that can really be dismissed? Or
you can present some factual evidence, but the factual evidence... Again, I don't know the Massachusetts rules, but the general rule, the federal rule, the rule that most states adopt and build off of, is that you can only look to what's actually in the complaint. You take everything in the complaint as true, or the pleadings. So if you have answers, you take everything that's in the pleadings as true, and you say, if this is true,
then.
Even if this is true, you can't state a claim. Even if this is true, it is not a defamatory statement because it's an opinion. Even if this is true, so there's that. The other thing is you can present evidence, but under most rules, if you present evidence outside of the pleadings, it converts it to a motion for summary judgment, which makes it a different standard. So it's a slightly different process there. But again, that's why they're a difficult thing to come to, because judges would rather have actual facts rather than assuming sentences are true and then basing a decision on that.
To make an example to go through that. So let's say I called somebody a spineless jerk.
How dare you?
I know, right? And then they sued, saying that this was defamation, and they said this was absolutely untrue. Here is an X-ray showing I have a spine, and therefore you have made a false statement. And then I might move to dismiss to say that my statement that you are a spineless jerk is an expression of opinion, that the term spineless in this context was not to reference that you did not in fact have a spine, but rather you were acting in a cowardly manner using, lack of backbone metaphorically. And then the judge could say, that does, in context, I look at this statement, it does seem that you were not actually making a factual statement. We do not need to go through a fact process to determine whether it's true the man had no spine. But therefore, we can determine that this is a statement of opinion, and therefore, I'm going to dismiss the lawsuit.
I'd also like to know if you'll now accept service on behalf of my client, Ketch.
And then I just want to also bring the slap back into it. Right. So under at least the California anti-slap law, which is the one that they are trying to apply in the Tech Dirt case, it allows you to actually require the person suing to put up their case a bit more, to put up the evidence that they have in order to prove the case, if there is to be a factual question. So this accelerates things a little bit. Though in this particular case, it is the Tech Dirt's position is that it's not about a factual dispute, that they are not saying, everyone agrees that factually he wrote this program and factually he called an email and so on, but that it is the opinion about what all those facts mean that is under dispute, while Shiva's side is saying that it is factual, and that that they should have a fact determination of what, you know, bring in some expert witnesses and determine what, you know, email is, and then that this is will be proven that in fact he did invent email as he sees it. And there was a hearing a couple of months ago, the judge was, by and large, just let the sides do their arguments. But the one question that he brought and was asking the attorneys was about what is email, and why is it isn't what email is a question of opinion. So that at least seems to be on the judge's mind.
And that sort of goes to the heart of what is email, because that is the heart of Shiva's case as well, is that this email is this very tightly, narrowly constructed thing that matches his description and his 80, 82, 78 program exactly. And that, and only that, is email, and all the rest that came after it is a derivative of it.
A variation based upon his great and underappreciated work.
The interesting thing about a defamation suit is that it's a risky thing for a plaintiff to bring, because if it's determined that it's not a defamatory statement, because whether or not you invented email is an opinion, then we can still be of different opinions about whether I invented email or not. But if Shiva goes through the efforts to attempt to prove factually that the facts are rock solid and certain, that he is the one true inventor of email, and is found wrong, then his entire, then there is a judicial finding that he is not the inventor of email. So whether it's an opinion or not is something that we can continue to dispute, and he can continue to carry on with his public career of claiming to be the inventor of email and selling books and public speaking as the inventor of email. But if the judge or jury actually gets to the point of a factual determination that he is not, then that's a real harm to his brand. So there's risk to this on his part. Now, I think he probably doesn't appreciate that, because I think he believes wholeheartedly that he's the inventor of email and will be vindicated, but I think that is a very big risk to the plaintiff, that he might end up with a finding against him that is far more detrimental to his brand than the Tech Dirt article ever was.
And I also suggest, I guess, to be as fair as possible to the other side. What I think there's a lot going on here in Gawker and on Tech Dirt and a lot of other articles, which have been, not only are they saying that what he invented is not actually, the email we know today, but also holding him to task for going out and saying that he was, and saying that this was being deceptive and misleading to people. And I think these are also expressions of opinion that are based on these stated facts. So I don't think it's actionable. But just so to be clear, if you guys haven't read the articles, and frankly, even more of them. You know, it is suggesting that he is not being a good actor by saying that he is the inventor of email. I think we had another question or two.
So, Kurt, I have a form and jurisdiction question about California. I know, right? One, what are California juries like where this guy is, where Tech Turk is having the case? And then the second is, can you get attorney's fees in California if Tech Turk prevails against him?
So those are good questions. And let me start with the second one first. An advantage of the California anti-slap law is that you can get fees if you are successful. And ordinarily in the American judicial system, each side will bear their own cost. This is called the American rule, contrast from the UK rule. You know, our legal system originated from jolly old England. And there the rule in many Commonwealth countries is that the loser pays just by as a matter of course. What this means is it raises the stake for a lot of litigation. It disincentivizes yourself from losing. It also means that you could have pretty high stakes even if you think you're going to win. If it's going to cost you a lot to get there, you better be right. So in any event, the anti-slap law brings that fee shifting into play. I don't know if Massachusetts, where it was filed, has that. So it may be that is part of the reason to have to bring into the California law. And you know, I know that strategy. I mean, there's a time when. EFF, we got sued for writing a blog post. We have a stupid patent of the month blog, and somebody didn't like their patent being called stupid, and they brought suit, and we were definitely arguing that the California anti-slap law would apply. It never came to much, and in that case, they dropped it within days. But in any event, that's part of it. And then your other question was about California juries, and I don't know if there's a notable opinion about whether California juries are better than Massachusetts juries on these sorts of points. But one important thing to think about jury trials is that if you are resource constrained, actually having something go before a jury and having it, you know, probably take several days to argue in front of the jury, that's really expensive. And so in that sense, in a strategic sense, if it actually comes down to the point where a jury is hearing something and coming to a decision, things have gone badly.
Any more questions?
There's one over here. Sorry?
It was similar to the...
Yeah, my question was similar to the other guys were about the attorney fee coverage. I didn't know anything about that, so you answered that already.
All right. There's a question, I think, in the second row here.
So I've been following Tech Turk kind of off and on for years, and I'm just wondering how or have the Tech Turk operations, are they still... Is the site still just operating business as normal, but there's this other thing to deal with right now, or has it affected operations?
I mean, they have written about this a fair amount, and they are still, you know, the site is operating. Mm-hmm. There is isupportjournalism.com, which is their site, trying to ask for people to help support them in the lawsuit through donations.
And merchandise.
Oh, yeah. Sweet.
For day-to-day operations, I know that since this has happened, whenever I've gone through the process with Pieces of Mind, it used to be, you know, fairly simple and quick and, you know, you look over and stuff. Now it's my last piece. It took a week and a half to go through, and, you know, we had to get a lot more approval, a lot more looking at it, and not sure about this, not sure about, you know, having to cross every T, dot every I, and it really slows down the process of news, and it really, it gives an intimidatory factor. You're afraid to go out on a limb somewhat, just in case somebody else is in the wings to try and, you know, piggyback on and split the resources even more with a second suit, and, oh, no, we can't afford that, we have to settle this or settle that, or figure out, just give up entirely, and it's a lot of pressure on that as well, and I think that the last piece I did was one on lithium batteries and the Department of Homeland Security's decision that all laptops must be in the hold, and how that was a bad idea in terms of fire, based on an incident and a thing. And even that was because there was some supposition, plus some knowledge from my own experience with battery fires, because I'm also a robotics engineer, or was. Using that basis, it made it. I had a good grounding for myself, but they're worried about airlines possibly thinking about it, or the DHS getting upset. Although, being a government agency, many state slap laws only apply to state sponsored actions. Some states are only kick in when a government agency is doing the thing. If I'm right, am I right?
There are a variety of anti-slap laws, and some of them are too narrow to apply to a more general discussion. I mean, actually, you know, if it's a TSA thing with the other thing, you know, you probably have a pretty good case that a slap law would apply there. But
I think Massachusetts one owns it mainly applies to government actors suing and not private entities suing. As in,
all right, don't happen to know.
I was kind of glancing and trying to think while you were talking.
But that actually does tie in with what I said earlier, the chilling effect that it has, if it's actually making, even if it doesn't mean that we're not going to comment on this particular case, or you know, if we're not going to report on this particular person, the fact that we're scrutinizing everything that much more, there's nothing wrong with the press trying to make sure that their article is right. I have no problem with that. But if you're going to go to a heightened level of scrutiny and really, really make every cautious effort to not put out anything that might even be opinion, then you're having a chilling effect. You're not putting out the articles you would have put out a month ago. You're not putting out the articles you would have put out 6 months ago. And that means that you're missing some aspect of that journalism.
Yeah, there's what's called pre-pub review is when you have a pre-publication review is when you have an attorney look over a piece before it gets published, attorneys can charge quite a bit per hour, and this can be a pretty hefty expense if you're doing it over every article. I don't think actually pre-pub review is necessary for every article. I think most journalists who've been in the business for a while have a pretty good sense of when they should call somebody in and look it over, and when they know what's going on. But still, that is something that you have to think about, and then it sort of slows down the editorial and publication process.
Yeah, even if it doesn't cost a penny, it's still slowing it down. You're going to be behind on the news. Other people break the story first, and that. It's still a cost either way.
I was going to say that I think one of the most sort of dangerous things for freedom of expression that can come from defamation lawsuits is that if you have something which you think is in fact true and you have good evidence to show that it is true, that if the cost of the litigation from the other side who will fight you on that is going to be overwhelming, you might not do a factually true article to avoid that cost and to avoid it being, you know, the thing that takes down your ability to go forward. And, you know, there's ways to mitigate against that. You can get insurance that would protect against defamation lawsuits, but you know, that's priced accordingly. If you're a major media publication, getting that kind of insurance is pretty pricey. And it would be the worst for freedom of expression if truthful statements that are controversial or about people who are particularly religious, litigious, are not being reported on. More questions.
Well, wait for the
When does your organization get involved in these cases? Like, what do you guys do to support them?
So, absolutely, good question. So, Electronic Frontier Foundation. So we have a number of attorneys, and we do pro bono legal work. That means for free, and we try to do what we can. Where we try to get involved is strategically in cases in which we can make a good precedent. So that by establishing that precedent, we'll be able to have an effect wider than the case at hand. One of the challenges in a defamation type scenario is this sort of very problem about the facts versus opinion. There can be cases in which a determination of what constitutional free expression law applies will set an important precedent, and those are the cases where it's about whether something's an opinion and such. If it comes down to whether a fact is true or not, that is something which is not going to have a precedential effect on other cases. It's just about that particular article, that particular story, and so on. So for our model of trying to have a wider application also means that a case where, you know, whether something is factually true or not is a core issue isn't a good case for the use of our you know, members' donations. That means that a number of important cases are not within our purview. The other thing is that because of this, we have about 17 lawyers, which is a fair number, but we have more requests that come in every day than we could possibly help with. And if we take on a case that goes to a trial, that will take a substantial number of those resources, so they wouldn't be available for other people. So we have occasionally gotten involved into defamation situations, but usually where it is a sort of a novel area of First Amendment law.
So my question kind of piggybacks off of that. Just mostly the idea that this guy claims that he invented email, or that he debates this idea, and I guess this is mostly asking for an opinion, since, you know, that's kind of what this base is on. I don't want to have anybody stating any facts, but I mean, you mentioned earlier about him not acting in good faith. I mean, how common is it that people will, like, really be reaching on something like what, like a basis of evidence? Most people would consider invented email invented what most people think of as email. So how often do things like that happen where this guy is like, oh, well, you know, I invented email, and he has to put air quotes around it because it's technically correct. But just not like
he doesn't put air quotes around it. He defines email as what he created, and then he defines it as that, and then everybody else piggybacked off him and learned from him. Well, he said that wasn't actually email. He said because it didn't use this exact system that he's got, that he defines as email, and then he points to a copyright registration he made for his program in 1982, and he says because you can't get trademark on it, and they didn't allow patents at the time, copyright was the only way to get the government to recognize it. And he said, and he puts that in all his material, that it's recognized by the U.S. government as him being the first to invent it through a copyright registration in 1982. That's how he spins it, that he invented email. That's E-M-E-E-M-A-I-L. No spaces, no hyphens, no nothing, just those five characters through the virtue of his copyright registration in 82, because that was the only way, using the dreaded term intellectual property laws, that the government could recognize what he created at that point. That's his argument. So,
and I think to the question, the plenty of people stretch the truth about what they've done. I mean, I read resumes all the time that maybe exaggerate a little bit about the successes people have had at their previous jobs. But
you want to see that? Look at my bio.
but the difference here, and what made it worthy of comment in journalism, and what is now worthy of litigation, is that this isn't just somebody puffing their own reputation to you know, look better in a certain instance. He's built an entire career out of being the inventor of email, not because he's getting any money for his email program, not because he's selling his software, but because he's writing books and doing speaking tours and
selling vitamin supplements.
Branding himself as the inventor of email.
At inventorofemail.com, I believe his website is.
So that's what made it a bigger deal, is that it's not just me maybe inflating my successes to you. It was holding himself out to the public at large and brandishing this.
I would say the other thing that really made this a notable case, or an important case, is that it was a $15 million claim damages lawsuit that, you know, if it were successful, would be the end of a prominent blog. The stakes were very high, and then also coupling that with how the same attorney had sued another prominent publication and had successfully brought it down. I mean, honestly, that's what brought it to my attention. Up until that point, I actually hadn't heard of his claims until the Gawker lawsuit sort of made it more prominent.
And it should be also noted that Shiva has somewhat of a flair for promotion as well. I mean, until recently, he was married to Fran Drescher, formerly of the Nanny, TV show The Nanny. They were married for 3 or 4 years, and as I say, now he's going for the Senate run on a Trump platform to boost his brand, because it's all about his brand, and he's done Reddit AMAs with or AMAs at the Donald, and that was not pleasant to read. A lot of I don't think Kurt took part, but I know Adam Steinberg and a few others took part, and when we asked questions, we were block kicked, and people started stalking us. He has some things, but he has a victim complex about certain things, because he believes that his Indian caste, which is a low one, is what causes it.
Eight minutes left.
One question.
Maybe someone asked this already, but since email is considered like a generic term these days, is there any chance to get the trademark overturned?
There is no trademark. It was a copyright.
So a copyright is about expression. So, you know, you can't copyright an idea. It is not about functionality. It is about expression. So it's designed to be for creativity, if I wrote a copyrighted computer program and got a registration on it, and then you wrote another program that did the exact same thing, you could get a registration on it, because your way of writing it is likely to be different from mine. And even if you happen to write it the same way that I wrote it, if you hadn't actually seen mine, then you would not be infringing upon it, because you don't have the element of copying. So it is sort of it's designed, you know, for authors. You copyright books, you copyright movies.
Ten cards would be a prime example. On this, Getech is not copyrightable. It's a name. It's a short thing to descriptive. The overall design is copyrighted to Scott because he owns the copyright because he did the design. The signage department here at DragonCon makes other tent cards which may also contain Getech and may also contain several other things, but it's a separate independent design and so therefore wouldn't be infringing on his copyright because he has the design but not the contents, so that's the difference.
And with that in mind, like, I don't think there's a problem with his copyright. You can get a copyright
copyright
in
the code of his program.
You know, yeah.
So even if it took him 30 seconds, he can still copyright it.
You could scribble on a piece of paper and have a copyright in that beautiful piece of art and send it in. And not only that, registration is a formality that is not necessary. This is kind of weird because it came, there was a time in which you had to actually get a registration for, you know,
74, right?
I think it was in the 76 Act.
76, right, yeah.
In any event, they got rid of formalities because there were, like, too many problems where somebody had, like, forgot to put a copyright notice in a book or whatever and then lost the copyright and yada, yada, yada.
Or didn't renew.
And then we move forward into a time period in which you are sort of like creating copyrighted works like all day long with everything you do, like every email you write is a copyrighted work that you have made and so on. And this is sort of caused weirdnesses. But be that as it may, a registration is basically an acknowledgement that you have filled out the form and sent it in. The reason that you would register, one is that if you do sue and you have a registered copyright, you can get more damages than you could if you don't. It's a prerequisite to actually filing suit, so you would have to do it before you actually litigated over someone copying your material. So it's a useful thing, but it's not necessary. You probably would only want to go and register things that you cared particularly about. But it is commonplace for people to copyright software programs.
Books.
Books, yeah. Well, books are much, much more common than software. Anyway, there's nothing particularly strange bad about registering a copyright in a software program, though I think also, you know, not one shouldn't make that out for more than it is.
Right? Yeah, it's just an expression of it, and that's all. As we only got
in the back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
it's recorded, so without the mic, it doesn't pick up on the recording.
Fair enough. So kind of piggybacking off of that, as far as copyright, trademark, patented. In your opinion, would you say that the argument that his copyright of email, like whatever it is that he did that he called email, really factually matters, like, to the idea of email, or would you need to have that under something more like rigorous, like a patent, or does copyright cover that?
So, to briefly go through the three main forms of intellectual property, as they say. So patent is about ideas, basically, about, you know, inventions. And so it's not about the expression, it's about the sort of what the thing does, or, Yeah, I mean, that could be part of it. You could also have, like, design patents,
rounded corners.
And the notion is that if you have a patent on some sort of, you know, method of doing things, you know, you invent a perpetual motion machine, then you would want to get a patent on that because, you know, people would be really interested in making a perpetual motion machine. By the way, that is, I think, the one thing that the patent office requires you to have a working sample of before they will consider your patent application. They get a lot of perpetual motion machine applications, and
I think that's a recent addition, though, isn't it?
Yeah. Patents last for a relatively short period of time, sort of 20-ish years. I'm not a patent expert, so, you know, this is like plus. Well, then there's like the.
It depends, first of all, on all that stuff, so yeah.
Versus a copyright, which is currently life of the author plus 70 years, and so like a very, very long time. Or if you're a corporation, then it's 95 years. And we'll find out if that lasts. The last time Disney's important copyrights like Mickey Mouse were coming up for going into the public domain, they got a 20-year extension on how long copyrights last.
And that was 19 years ago.
And right, so it's coming up soon. So it may be that Mickey Mouse will go into the public domain. Or not.
Or
we'll
maybe
out.
We have another extension.
And then finally, trademark, which is actually... That's a consumer protection statute. It's so that if you go and order a particular product, you go to a store and ask for an iPhone, that they give you the Apple iPhone and not an Android. And if somebody puts an Android and writes iPhone on it, then they are violating the trademark. Though ironically, Apple didn't own the trademark to iPhone when it launched the product and called it iPhone.
Some Chinese company.
Cisco.
Oh yeah, Cisco with that
video phones. They had been negotiating apparently, and like it was taking a while to do negotiations. They're like, whatever. But you know, when that's something that not recommended from the legal point of view, but they did.
To put it another way, though, in simple terms, patent is the idea of having a water bottle. Copyright is the design of the water bottle, and trademark is the patent on the label that tells you who the brand is. That's a simple
the name of it.
Yeah, the name of the label and the design, you know, just.
But that's why it's important to recognize the claim for what it is. So the copyright, again, there's nothing wrong with the copyright. It's probably perfectly legitimately copyrighted. It's his legitimately unique expression of his email program. But it does not necessarily convey any idea that his is the first or only email program. There can be multiple copyrights of the same idea. There can be many, many ways of expressing the same concept. And the Romeo and Juliet story obviously is not copyrighted, but that idea. How many different star-crossed lovers stories can be written, and each and every one of them is independently copyrighted, but it doesn't mean that any one of them was the inventor of that concept. So it's taking the registration and giving it some his assertion that this is the government saying that I have definitively invented email. Is taking that registration and stretching its actual proof to insignificance to a bit more broad extent.
I think, which has got to be the last question because we've come to 11 o'clock.
So he's trying to use copyright as if it's a patent.
Basically.
In
the court of public opinion, certainly, to run down run through the courts, mm-hmm. and to outspend. Because he's just got $750,000 from the Gorka settlement.
I mean, just to, like, a lot of it, I think, does come down to this, what is email? And if you take his view that the thing that he wrote is email, and then the fact that it got registered, it just is like a timestamp. It shows, this did happen. Here is a copy of the program. So if somebody said that they invented email and they just pulled out this old floppy disk, found a computer that would accept a floppy disk and looked at it, and there was something that was called email on it, it wouldn't seem as impressive. You're like, well, did you just make that up? Did you write this, disk more modern, more recently, and then change the date on it? So, I mean, there is sort of an advantage to having a timestamp on when it happened, but it doesn't change from the core issue that seems to be going on here is what do we mean by email? And do we mean the thing that he wrote is email and therefore he is the inventor of email? Or do we mean by email something else, which is the messaging system that existed prior to that that have evolved later and what it is? And I think what Tech Dirt's position and others is that what he did is not properly considered to be email in their constitutionally protected opinion. And I think he is disputing that and saying that is a factual matter. And to that end, the registration is like a minor point, I think, along the way. right, we've gone actually a little bit over time, so thank you everybody for coming out on your
Sunday morning and not going to see William Shatner or whoever else.
Yeah, I think Shatner was this morning, so.